Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is November 8, 1981, and this is my audio letter number 69. A few days ago, on the morning of November 4, the eyes of the world were on Cape Canaveral, Florida. An American space shuttle sat poised for launch on Pad 39A, the home of America's moon flights a decade ago. According to NASA, the shuttle was scheduled for launch at 7:30 that morning. What we were watching, my friends, was another NASA publicity hoax. NASA had no intention of actually launching the shuttle that day. The shuttle now at Cape Canaveral is not the Columbia as claimed. It is the training shuttle Enterprise, as I reported last June in Audio Letter 65. It is there for only one reason, to help NASA buy time. It was the Enterprise, not the Columbia, that we saw making that dramatic landing in California last April. Most Americans are unaware that the Columbia was destroyed in space after it took off from Cape Canaveral. NASA is continuing to buy time, while secret modifications of the next space shuttle are underway at White Sands, New Mexico. And so right now, we're seeing hoaxes like the aborted countdown on November 4. As I mentioned a moment ago, NASA had no intention of allowing an actual launch earlier this week. What they did want was an exciting countdown to sustain public interest and explain away the next delay. The key to the NASA publicity show was the master countdown computer called the Automatic Sequencer. It was deliberately programmed to delay the countdown at T-minus 9 minutes, and then to stop it completely just 31 seconds before launch. With those arrangements made, NASA forged ahead with its pretended launch preparations. For several days ahead of time, NASA spokesman solemnly said that the weather would have to be almost perfect at launch time. The reason, we were told over and over, was that the shuttle might have to abort its takeoff and glide back to land at Cape Canaveral. That is exactly the plan which I made public last June in Audio Letter 65. The military shuttle planners are still actively considering a deliberately aborted launch soon, and they want to prepare us in case they carry it out. But on November 4, the launch preparations were only make-believe. And so NASA pressed ahead with the countdown, with only lip service to the worsening weather. The countdown went without a hitch to the T-minus 9 minutes mark, and then stopped for a final planned hold. We were told that this was the decision point, when launch control would either go ahead or scrub. Newsmen craned their necks at the worsening clouds and shook their heads. It began to rain on spectators 10 miles from the launch pad. Then the rain reached the VIP stand, twice as close to the shuttle. Next, rain started pelting TV reporters at their forward outposts, closest of all to the launch pad. Surely, they said, NASA would have to scrub the launch. But to NASA launch control, only the countdown itself mattered that day. They knew there could be no launch because the countdown computer had been programmed to prevent it. And so the announcement from NASA surprised many. Their decision was to go ahead for a launch. The final 9 minutes of the countdown were used to help lay the foundation for things to come. First, the countdown computer refused to resume the count at T-minus 9 minutes. Shortly, NASA announced that it was merely a computer programming problem. Moments later, the count began. Everything went smoothly until T-minus 31 seconds. Then the count stopped again. Once again, said NASA, it was a programming goof. The shuttle itself was fine, we were told, but the computer had not been given the right instructions. By that point, my friends, it was a critical point in the count, so close to launch. The shuttle fuel tanks had been sealed up, ready to go. The shuttle had been cut loose from its ground links and was trembling with power, ready to go. All kinds of things had to be shut down, cooled off, reset, and recycled for another try. For the next 2 hours or so, television reports concentrated on how crucial computers are to the shuttle. They ended up making one basic point, and that is, even if the shuttle itself is in perfect condition, a mistake in programming its computers can cause the unexpected to happen. This, my friends, is NASA's way of getting us ready to accept it if they do carry out a so-called return to landing site abort. They will say afterward that it was all caused by a computer programming problem. They will emphasize that the shuttle itself performed perfectly, and so the shuttle project should not be interfered with. Finally, when they are ready for the third shuttle launch, they will assure us that the computer problems have all been solved. This, my friends, was the true purpose of the November 4 shuttle countdown hoax. They have now paved the way for an aborted takeoff soon, if they choose to carry out the plan I made public in Audio Letter 65. Having accomplished that much, the NASA launch team finally scrubbed the November 4 launch with a different excuse. We're being told that the hydraulic power units, called APUs, need an oil and filter change. And with that story, NASA is once again buying more time. Using one excuse after another, NASA has succeeded so far in slipping the next shuttle launch time after time without arousing public suspicion. It's now almost 7 months since the first shuttle launch on April 12, 1981. Even so, these delays cannot continue indefinitely. The countdown for the space shuttle program is only part of a far greater countdown, the countdown toward nuclear war one. Earlier this year of 1981, I revealed that the American Bolsheviks here are trying to follow a definite timetable in their war plans. That timetable calls for the war sequence to begin around mid-1982. A chain of events will begin that is to culminate finally in nuclear war one. My friends, up to now, they are still on that timetable. Mid-1982 is less than a year away now, and so, regardless of the low chances of success, the military space shuttle team will have to try a launch soon. Whatever they try will be a desperate gamble in light of Russia's overwhelming military power in space. But time is slipping away for the space shuttle. The choice is gradually becoming either use it or lose it. The state socialists here, the American Bolsheviks, who now control America's military policies, are in a frenzy to throw America's nuclear arsenal at Russia. During recent weeks, this military frenzy has been manifesting itself in many ways. These range from the so-called Reagan administration decision on the MX missile and B-1 bomber to shocking statements about limited nuclear war. At the same time, America's economy is being dragged down into an inflationary depression to set the stage for dictatorship. And most ominous of all, my friends, a specific act has taken place since my last audio letter report that has lit one of the fuses for war. In a number of recent tapes, I have discussed the similarity between the multiplying crises of today and those that led up to World War I. Those crises set the stage, but a specific incident acted as the trigger that led to war. That event, my friends, was the unexpected assassination of a key political figure. It happened in 1914, and now, in 1981, it has happened again. My three special topics for this audio letter are topic number one, the Sadat assassination for nuclear war one. Topic number two, the Reagan administration program to Polandize America. And topic number three, the MX decision and America's first strike posture. Topic number one, assassination politics can be counted on always to strike without warning. One fateful day, it struck in a capital city not far from the Mediterranean Sea. The day began without a hint of what was about to happen. The Mediterranean sun was bright and warm, the sort of day that is perfect for picnics and parades. An unusual leader was scheduled to be seen in public appearances on that fateful day. He was a strong-minded man, not universally admired, but certainly an attention-getter. For his public appearances that day, he was all decked out with a full complement of medals to enhance his image. He was a controversial man, and his policies were stirring up heated debate. He had staked out a course in foreign policy that set him apart from others in his region. There were many who did not like his ideas. Throughout the region in which this unusual man lived, deep divisions were threatening to explode into violence. The central problem had to do with a disenfranchised minority who were scattered through parts of the several nations. This minority group were the victims of great power maneuvering that had changed the map a generation earlier. They had been left without the national identity they craved and scattered through parts of several nations. For decades, the people of this disenfranchised minority had been struggling to regain their rights, and slowly but surely, they were growing more powerful. These facts weighed heavily in the mind of the controversial leader on that bright, sunny day. He was convinced that the course which he was promoting was the right one. He was involved in negotiations that could lead to a form of regional autonomy for the disenfranchised minority. They would be given this autonomy within the nations where they lived. His public appearances on that sunny day were intended to underscore his determination to continue down his chosen course. It was only a matter of time, he thought, until his own diplomatic ideas brought lasting peace to his troubled region and honor to himself. That was this man's dream, my friends. But the dream ended abruptly as a nightmare. In the warmth of the bright Mediterranean sun, the chilling shock of assassination politics suddenly intervened. There was a hail of gunfire, and this man, who had staked out such an independent course, lay dead. The assassination was followed immediately by questions piled on more questions. How big was the conspiracy? The answer at first appeared to be only a handful, perhaps 4 or 5 men. Later, there were hints that it might have been much bigger than that. What about the suspicious behavior of the neighboring government toward the assassinated leader? The evidence was conflicting about that. And why had effective protection been so completely lacking for such an important leader? To this day, my friends, that question remains a mystery. It is often said that history repeats itself. And so it does, my friends, if only we can learn to see it. I have just described not just one historical event, but two. One of these events was the assassination of the entity known as President Anwar Sadat of Egypt last month on October 6th. The other event, which fits exactly the same description, was an assassination which took place 67 years ago. I am referring to the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria on June 28, 1914. The assassination last month took place in the Egyptian capital city of Cairo, some 100 miles south of the Mediterranean coast. The victim was the entity President Sadat. Over the past half decade, Sadat had become highly controversial and isolated in the Arab world. The reason for this was his involvement with Israel by way of the so-called Camp David Accords. The great problem in the Middle East today is, of course, that of the Palestinians. They are the disenfranchised minority of today, victims of the great power of map-making which created Israel a generation ago. The Palestinians, largely dispossessed from their former homeland, are today scattered like orphans throughout several nations. But they have never lost their determination to regain their rights and their national identity. And slowly but surely, they are growing more powerful. Most Arab leaders today support these Palestinian aspirations in undiluted form. But 4 years ago, Sadat broke ranks with his Arab brothers by his unilateral overtures toward Israel. From that time onward, Sadat became identified with a sort of halfway solution to the Palestinian problem. That solution is called autonomy, quote unquote. These days, we hear frequently about so-called autonomy talks between Egypt and Israel. To you and me, thousands of miles away from the scene, the concept of regional autonomy for the Palestinians may sound pretty good. But to the Palestinians themselves, it is no solution at all. They see it as nothing more than a way to lock them into their present homeless status for all time. And, my friends, they are exactly right about that. After all, the Palestinians themselves are not even party to the so-called autonomy talks, which are to decide their fate. So this was the situation last month on October 6. The Middle East, seething with unresolved tensions from great power map-making of a generation earlier, a disenfranchised minority struggling to reestablish their national identity, and a single unorthodox leader seeking a halfway solution based on so-called regional autonomy for the minority. It sounds like a situation unique to our age. But, my friends, it is not unique. In important ways, it is almost a carbon copy of the situation that exploded into World War I. In 1914, the hot spot of the world was not the Middle East, but the Balkan Peninsula. The disenfranchised minority of that day were not the Palestinians, but the grouping of peoples known collectively as the Yugoslavs. Yugoslavia, as we know it today, did not exist in 1914. Instead, the map of the region was a patchwork of names like Serbia, Bosnia, and Herzegovina. Scattered throughout the region were the interrelated Yugoslav peoples. They had been robbed of their power and identity a generation earlier, and they wanted it back. For several years before the outbreak of World War I, these tensions led repeatedly to outbreaks of fighting in the Balkans. Into this dangerous situation stepped Archduke Franz Ferdinand, heir to the throne of Austria, of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. He was afraid the Balkan situation could lead to a breakup of his empire. And so he proposed a halfway solution to pacify the Yugoslavs while preserving the status quo. His plan for this disenfranchised minority was called regional autonomy. It was virtually a prototype for the so-called autonomy plan we hear about today for the Palestinians. The Yugoslavs were no more pleased with the so-called autonomy idea in 1914 than the Palestinians are today in 1981. It was a situation made to order to set the stage for assassination. That was true in 1914, and it was true again in 1981, barely a month ago. The two assassinations differed in detail, but in overall pattern they were much the same. Archduke Ferdinand appeared in an open car wearing the medals and trappings of royalty. Sadat appeared at a parade dressed in the medals and trappings of the military. Both were shot to death without the assassins being interfered with by security personnel until too late. Both were killed in capital cities near the Mediterranean. Archduke Ferdinand in the provincial capital of Sarajevo, Bosnia. Sadat in Cairo, Egypt. Both assassinations were followed immediately by suspicion directed against a neighboring state. In the case of Sadat, the suspicions were aimed at neighboring Libya. In the case of Archduke Ferdinand, it was Serbia that drew accusations. And those accusations, my friends, initiated a process that led directly to World War I. If all these things were not enough, there is one other crucial similarity today with the situation in 1914. On the eve of World War I, there were two great power blocks opposing one another in Europe. One was called the Triple Entente, consisting of Britain, France, and Tsarist Russia. The other was the Triple Alliance, made up of Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Italy. These two great power blocks were something new and dangerous in continental politics. They were permanent alliances instead of the temporary special-purpose alliances of the past. They were the legacy of balance-of-power politics from the era of Bismarck and Disraeli. The two blocks were so evenly matched that it was thought that they would keep the peace. But they both shared a common weak spot. That weak spot was the Balkan Peninsula. In themselves, the Balkans were minor players on the world stage. But there were treaties between the Balkan mini-states and the great powers. It was through those ties that the great powers were pulled into what became World War I. Today, my friends, we live once again in an era when two great power blocks have been facing each other for decades. One is centered on Russia, and the other on the United States, together with their allies. For example, in Europe itself, NATO stands eyeball to eyeball with the Warsaw Pact, year in, year out. Today, it is far worse than in 1914. It is more complicated, and secret alliances are now being forged. And just as 1914 had its weak spot in the Balkans, the 1981 weak spot is the Middle East, together with the Persian Gulf. In 1914, the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand came as a shock to the world. It was the trigger that started a chain of events that culminated in World War I. Austria-Hungary accused Serbia of complicity in the assassination and issued a harsh ultimatum. Little Serbia responded by appealing to Russia for protection, and Russia agreed to provide it. Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia. Russia started mobilizing. Austria-Hungary appealed to its ally Germany, which promptly declared war on Russia. Germany asked Russia's ally France to stay out of it, but the French were evasive. Germany then declared war on France and prepared to march through Belgium to attack France. Britain gave a warning to Germany not to violate Belgium's neutrality. The Germans started marching anyway. Britain declared war on Germany. The situation kept on snowballing like this until all of Europe was aflame with war. It was a war for which there could emerge no winners, except for unseen powerful forces behind the scenes. But those forces had succeeded in setting off the unwinnable war for their own selfish ends, and they started it all with a surprise assassination. When I recorded Audio Letter 68 on September 30, I gave a warning that the entity Sadat was being set up for assassination. The state socialists, or American Bolsheviks here, are trying to set off nuclear war I by means of techniques similar to those which led to World War I 67 years ago. And the time had come at last to use Sadat to help further the plan for war. Contrary to appearances, the late President Anwar Sadat did not initiate negotiations with Israel 4 years ago on his own initiative. Instead, he had been turned into an involuntary puppet of the United States and Israel. I first revealed what had been done to Sadat 4 years ago this month in Audio Letter 28. Up until the spring of 1977, Anwar Sadat had always rejected the idea of direct negotiations with Israel. In April of that year, Sadat visited Washington for talks with the then-President Carter. When reporters asked whether he would consider direct negotiations with Israel, Sadat again dismissed the idea as too drastic. Yet a little more than 6 months later, Sadat electrified the world with his sudden peace initiative and visit to Israel. In Audio Letter 28, I reported what had happened to Sadat to so radically change his thinking. Sadat had been subjected to the psychological programming techniques which are secretly in use by the United States and other intelligence agencies. He was programmed with an irresistible compulsion to go against all of his past thinking and deal directly with Israel. The bottom line was what I reported 4 years ago. To repeat what I reported then, quote, "The Sadat Peace Initiative to Israel is supposed to be, unknown to Sadat himself, the first step toward war," unquote. Last month, the Sadat image was put to its final use by the secret joint military junta of the United States Pentagon and Israel. The assassination in Cairo ended the Sadat era, and at the same time, it started the countdown toward collapse of the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty on the way to war. Within hours of the assassination, Israeli leaders began expressing doubts whether the peace will survive without Sadat, and they said that this could cause a reappraisal of the plan for Israel to complete its withdrawal from the Sinai on schedule next spring. When Archduke Franz Ferdinand was assassinated in June of 1914, it led very quickly to the outbreak of war. The war was getting underway by early August, a scant 6 weeks after the assassination. Today, the same unseen forces and their principals are at work, but the situation is more complicated. As a result, it would be a mistake to expect the same timetables to apply. But the hollow echoes of 1914 are growing louder and louder in the Middle East today. For the moment, the complex maneuvers of the American Bolshevik Zionist junta of the United States and Israel are shifting to other areas than Egypt. On one hand, we are hearing more and more about Libya. We're gradually being conditioned to the idea that the Libyan strongman, Gaddafi, is a madman who might do just about anything. This, my friends, is just another ingredient which is being prepared to be thrown into the American Bolshevik Zionist war cauldron. When the right moment arrives, Gaddafi can be programmed to do something seemingly insane to help bring on war. As long ago as 1974, I reported over radio station WMCA in New York that Libya is under the United States CIA control. Gaddafi and his henchmen have been brought to the United States and trained by the CIA to carry out a coup d'etat. Gaddafi then went back, carried out the coup, and installed himself as Libya's new leader. He also installed the CIA as his indispensable helper. These, my friends, are the facts behind the shocking recent reports of American involvement in Libya. But more important than Libya is Saudi Arabia. When I recorded Audio Letter 68 on September 30, it seemed that the crucial AWACS deal with Saudi Arabia was in trouble. But I reported that Israel secretly wanted the AWACS deal to be approved. This is part of the plan to set up Saudi Arabia to look like a credible threat to Israel. That will give Israel the excuse it needs to carry out a limited nuclear strike on the Saudi oil fields. My friends, the decisive turning point in the AWACS debate was the assassination of Anwar Sadat. From that day onward, undecided United States senators started coming down in favor of the AWACS deal. Some key senators even changed from being against it to being for it and said the Sadat assassination had changed their minds. On October 28, the AWACS sale to Saudi Arabia was approved by the United States Senate. It was the point of no return for the Middle East. The peace overtures of the late Anwar Sadat have served their intended purpose. These peace overtures have started the world down the road to thermonuclear war.